enzymes in our body. And then the things that blueprint the whole thing, the genetic material, the nucleic acids. And you know what? If you go to a cockroach, you will find that the DNA, the blueprint material in a cockroach, is pretty much, it is exactly the same thing that you find out here in the grass, or that you find in your own body. That's a lot of similarity, isn't it? The coding material throughout all living organisms is the same. It's this. The same five bases that go to make that up. And you usually see it in your textbooks like this. Now I'll leave that on for those who are taking notes. No. Here are your amino acids. The amino acids are about 22 little beads that can be strung together in 100,000 million different ways to make proteins and enzymes. And they are the same out here in this grass as they are in you. Now that's fact. And what they're saying is that the only logical way you can explain it is that they all evolved from a common ancestor. And I don't think that's the only logical way to explain it. Let's just say that we go out here in the community. I've still got the one that's misspelled. You guys got, you know, I'm just trying to show myself to be human. Genetically, it's not spelled right. You get that? You know, I didn't make this one up. None of y'all probably ever make mistakes like that, but let's just get to the point of it. How would you explain the similarity in a row of houses that are all built the same? Would you say that they evolved from a common ancestor, or would you say that they related to a common designer? Well, we say they related to a common designer. For years and years and years, and even now, there are lots of biologists who feel that that particular similarity in living organisms also points to a common design. All right, and not to the idea necessarily that everything has evolved from some single source in a primeval ocean that nobody ever saw and cannot reproduce. Can't do a test like that. Can't observe it. Can't do experiments on it. What's the difference? I'll tell you why I think it's that way. Because of this. We are an ecologically aware society. You feel guilty when you litter. You feel bad when you're wading in the stream, you know, and trash floats down past you. And you know that you can't drink most of that water because it's all dirty and it has to be cleaned up. And it didn't used to be that way. We're ecologically oriented in our society. And most of us have been taught about the food web or about food chains, technically. You know, the rabbit eats the grass. It actually goes back to some of those nursery rhymes about the little fish eaten by the big fish, eaten by the big fish. Well, just so you know, the little fish was eating algae in the plankton. That's like grass to a cow. Okay? That's simple enough, isn't it? You got rabbits who eat grass, and you got fox who eat rabbits, and you got some humans who are ornery enough to eat fox. And when all of that stuff dies, it goes back into the soil and decomposes, and some other plant takes it in as a nutrient. We call that the food web, and we have mineral cycles and the water cycle and all that kind of stuff. And do you understand that? Now, let me ask you this. If all of life did not have this common design, the rabbits couldn't use the grass as food. The fox could not use the rabbit as food, and we could not eat the fox. And when we all died, we could not be used to start that cycle all over, could we? I mean, the reason that I can eat steak, and there have been times in my life when I have been able to afford that, I go to the window at Western Sizzling sometimes and just kind of watch, just so I don't forget how people do that. The reason that I can eat steak is because the same kinds of amino acids are in that meat protein, and my body can break it down and string them out the way I need it, so that I can have muscle and be strong. Now, doesn't that also explain the similarities? Can you understand that a God who wanted a world like we have it, with the food chain and the food web and everything interrelated like that, might create everything with that common design so that it can be used as food? Makes perfect sense to me. Now, which one of those do you accept? Which one is supported scientifically, and which one do you accept on faith? Neither one of them are supported scientifically. Whichever position you take on that, you'll take on faith. And that's my whole point. Now, I'm not embarrassed about admitting that I believe on faith certain things about origin and creation and all of that. But a biologist ought not be embarrassed to say that it's a matter of faith that they believe that this primeval ocean existed. They never did see it, did they? I can't run over to Western Africa and find one floating around over there where spontaneous generation is occurring. They've postulated a sequence of events and a chemical atmosphere and conditions on this earth that we can't find any place on the face of the earth, and we have never seen any place, but that's what they think would have had to been there. Isn't that a matter of faith? And don't some of them believe it awfully strongly? Because they can pound the pulpit just like we can. And they can get red in the face and they can say, I'm not trying to be honest, but the point is that I believe on faith and they believe on faith. Now, which one scientifically proven? Neither one of them. Now, can you prove scientifically that things are similar? Sure. I can demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that amino acids, wherever I find them, are pretty much the same little beast. And that the nucleic acids that make up the genetic material that determine whether you're sitting there with blonde hair or brown hair or no hair or blue eyes and what have you, all of that stuff is the same wherever you find it. But that's a fact. How it got that way is a matter of faith, no matter which direction you go. Now, you see the way I'm approaching that? I've tried to give you some evidence, and then I've tried to give you the evolutionary explanation in the best way I know how, the strongest one that I can give you. There's some things there that you can't explain, but why bring that up? Because there's some things there that I can't explain. But I can explain the vast majority of it from my point of view. And whichever one a person chooses is a matter of a reasoned faith. A reasoned faith. That's all that God ever asked his people to have. And it won't ever be scientifically proven, not even by the Creation Research Society. Let me just tell you that. Which seems to be the direction that they're coming from. They want to imply that somehow they're going to go out and find evidence that is just going to demonstrate the creation by God beyond the shadow of a doubt, and that it's never going to happen because that's just not the way things are set up. Origins are outside the realm of science. The general theory of evolution is a matter of origin. And that's where the Bible disagrees with the scientific community. But it is not over things like natural selection, artificial selection, and the special theory of evolution. And you need to understand that. Because if you go out and you don't make that distinction, all you're doing is helping all these other people confuse the issue. You know, and I hate to put that burden on you, but it's gotten to be a rather touchy situation. I taught it that way at the University of Florida. I'd suggest to you that if I were in a university position now, I would be told I could not teach it that way. And if I insisted on it, I would be asked to leave. That's the situation that we're in now. Now, I gave this presentation. This is important. This is even more important than the water fountain. I gave this presentation to the Vice President of Academic Affairs at Georgetown College, who is their Old Testament professor. It's a small Baptist school where I preach. In the town. You know what I mean. To him privately, with the past and present heads of the biology department, the past head of the biology department, who is going to retire next year, older man. The new head of the biology department, a young man, very young, about my age, and coming through school at different times, and to the philosophy professor who teaches courses on science and religion. Just the four of them and me and Darlene, my wife, sitting up here in the blue. Silver hair, pretty lady. You can meet her later. They're all theistic evolutionists. They believe God created through evolution. And you know, we went through all of this. And you know, they had never heard that kind of approach. And you know, they never argued with me about it. They'd never heard that kind of approach. But the point I wanted to make was this. The older man who was the biology professor said, well, you know, it wasn't pushed when I went through school. And a lot of you who are older here, it wasn't pushed on you when you went through school and you dealt with it years ago, and things like this you're not really sure are really necessary. And I understand that. But I was interested in what the younger man said, because although he disagreed with me, okay, he does not accept the six-day creation and the Genesis flood. He said it was crammed down his throat when he went through, and that's the truth. And that's exactly what happened to me, and it's even worse now than it was back in 1970 when they did it to me. And it isn't going to go away. And I suggest to you that you need to try to learn this kind of approach. Let's talk to students about the evidence. Show them clearly where the evidence stops and where the interpretation begins. Give them whatever interpretations people want to give. You know, if you've got a Babylonian friend who wants to come in with his Gilgamesh epic, fine. You know, let him come in. I haven't run into one recently. But you never know. Some people keep strange friends. But the two basic ones that people even take seriously are the biblical account and its interpretation of the evidence, and the naturalistic account, the general theory of evolution, you know, with its explanation. So why can't we give that stuff to students and let them make up their own mind? Now, I don't happen to be for legislation. I just tell you, if you're going to ask me later, I just tell you I'm not for it. Because right now, I can go any place I want to and talk on any campus that I want to and be invited into any high school that I want to. So why don't I just go do that rather than force some biology teacher who doesn't want to teach it and doesn't believe in it and force them to teach creation to my child? I got real problems with that. I'd much rather be the one to do that. What I think we need to do is to produce materials that can be used as supplementary reading that make this kind of distinction and get them into the schools and let people do it that way. There's no person that teaches in a high school that gets galled any more than when the legislature tells the state board they got to do something and the state board tells the local board and their local superintendent says you're going to do it or you can't. You know, people just don't function well under that. You know, and I don't think they do a very good job of it, if you want to know the truth. And right now, people are not disallowing people like myself to come into the school. Now, that's one example And if I don't stop now, you're going to be angry with me because we said we were going to stop 15 minutes ago and get a drink and all that kind of stuff, which is what we're going to do. Don't ask any questions because I probably can't answer it and then I'll be embarrassed. Just go get your drink.
Let's try to keep it to about 5 minutes if we can.
In the beginning, God created Darwin and Eve. Isn't that great? Here's another one. You make these overheads, you got to use them. I mean, here's one I found in the paper that was sent to me from North Carolina. Personally, I wish they would teach creation along with evolution. I never did believe in the literal interpretation of Darwin. Some of these people are getting clever. Now they are. Let's talk about fossil men. The evidence for fossil men is exactly like it is for comparative anatomy. If you stand an ape up here next to me, and you're able to tell us apart, there will hopefully be differences that you notice and similarities that you notice. You know, the difference, you won't have on a suit. And that's all that the evidence really is. When I did these charts, I was doing it for a graduate level, and so I have all scientific quotations out of current biology textbooks that were being used at the college level. And that's what I've got to simplify, okay, in the stuff that all of us can understand. The evolutionist interpretation is the same, that apes and man are so similar, they obviously evolved from a common ancestor, and they've pumped millions of dollars into trying to find that common ancestor, the so-called missing link. Okay? When I was in class, this is fun to play with. I forgot how. I like it. This was what was put up in front of me. My professor, I'm not very tall, so. My professor just held that out and said, David, here is the evidence for the evolution of man. Now, David, where do you draw the line between ape and man? Well, I couldn't do it. And I kind of sheepishly left because I couldn't answer that one. That's one he got me on. And it took a while before I began to realize what I was dealing with. This isn't evidence. This is evidence plus the evolutionary interpretation. Now, this was sent out as a promo to a Time Life series on the evolution of man and early man and so on. And you can't draw a line in there because they've added their interpretation in such a way as to make no line. That wasn't what they were trying to show. So I got interested in how they did all of that, and I asked my professor, and he gave me this chart. He said, what we do is we take the skeleton of a modern ape and the skeleton of a modern man, and we look for areas of non-overlap. Doesn't do any good to look and see how many fingers they have because we all have the same number. You see what I mean? That doesn't help us. Well, this has two eyes, and this has two eyes. That doesn't help you. They look for things that are not the same and don't overlap. And if you look at the characteristics, it's a little hard to see this. They all have to do with the bony structure of this thing, primarily with the skull and the dental work. Okay, the dentition. The posture, an anthropoid ape has a backbone that just kind of goes down like that, and ours has that double curve that y'all heard that advertisement have you about, you know, man wasn't created to stand upright, and that's why we all have these back problems, and you need to buy a posturpedic mattress. General theory of evolution finds its way into some interesting applications. Last year, it was interesting to me that Star Trek and Superman and Star Wars were the big movies, okay? And they are nothing but an extrapolation of the general theory of evolution. I mean, Chewbacca is nothing but an evolutionary mutant, right? Now, it's good science fiction. I just don't think it ought to be taught as fact if it is an interpretation. I don't mind them making fantasies out of it, but I don't think they ought to tell everybody that it's fact when it's an interpretation. And so this was the chart he gave me, and he had this on here about body hair being reduced on humans and extensive on apes. You know, he wanted me to take that off because he knew, really, that that wasn't, you couldn't know that. You know why you shouldn't know that? Because when you find these fossils, they don't have anything like that on. That all you have left, if you're lucky, is a few of the bones. Now, I was kind of ignorant. I was real ignorant then. I'm less ignorant now. I went to the head of the anthropology department at U of L, and I asked him how they reconstruct these things. You know, how do they take fragments of bones and then add in all the pieces that aren't there and then put the organs on and add the skin and the hair and the facial features and all that kind of stuff? And I wanted to know, and he wanted to know why I wanted to know. Interesting, that was his first question. Why do you want to know that? And he said, there's only 4 or 5 people in the world that can do that. I said, well, I might want to be the 5th. I said, how do you find out information like that? He said, you know, I've heard that some of these things that are so-called missing links or intermediate forms have been reconstructed off of very scarce, very few number of bones, and a lot of the stuff's been added in. And he readily admitted it was that way, and he gave me the example that I used. He was the one who pointed out to me. You know, I'm like everybody else. I don't read the fine print. I look at the pictures, you know. And if I'd have read the fine print, I'd have found out that Ramapithecus, well, I got to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He's 5th over right there. Ramapithecus is the classic example of that. He said, I'll tell you what, listen to this. They call it a human, or in the human line, on the basis of a few teeth, some fragments of the jawbone, and a palate unmistakably human in shape. Now, the palate's where your peanut butter gets stuck. They had the palate, no peanut butter, they had the palate, they had a piece of the jaw, and some teeth. Okay? And I said, that's exactly what I want to know. You know, how do they go about doing that? And his answer was this. When you know what came before and what came after it, you just fill in the missing part. Now think on that one a minute. When you know what came before it and what came after, you just fill in the missing part. Now there's a big assumption there, isn't there? That the general theory is true. Now I don't deny a scientist a right to go get grant money and do that and put the evidence together that way. I just wish that a student in high school was aware that this guy right here isn't all he appears to be. That what they actually have as evidence is much less than what you see. Now what they do is this. They take the skeleton, then they add in the brain and muscles and internal organs, and they put skin on it. And now they don't put hair on it because they've admitted that you can't know any way, shape, or form how much hair there is. And Ramapithecus was kind of a good one because Ramapithecus shows up on a lot of these charts as being kind of the intermediate form. Now, that depends on whose chart you're looking at, and that's changed about 20 times over the course of the years, which I don't want to get into today. Now, for the chart that I showed you, here is the actual amount of evidence that was available. When that chart came out, somebody went and figured it out. Okay, and Ramapithecus is right up here, 5 down from the top, right where he ought to be. 2 teeth, I'll read it up here, 2 jaws, 3 teeth, and the palate. Now here's your picture. Right? So let's just take off the hair and the skin, which they admit is not there. You can't know anything about it. Then let's just take off the muscle and the internal organs, which do not fossilize. you know. And then let's just take off the part of that skeleton they don't have. Now, I probably would have had difficulty recognizing him as an ape or a man. For the so-called critical fossils, the ones that are, you know, really supposed to be intermediate, you can do the same thing for every one of them. Louis B. Leakey had a creature called Zinjanthropus that was put in this position for a while. And he said he had the most remarkably well-preserved skull that had ever been found in the study of early man. And that skull was in 400 pieces with a bunch of gaps. That's the best they ever did. This is common. And sometimes you'll hear preachers say that you could put most of the evidence that would be critical and pile it all up and it wouldn't fit in a peach basket, and that is the truth. That's the truth. Now, if you go back to this chart, you'll notice that the things... I got to be careful to fold that up or I'll break it. And it took something to get that one together. And I'll break your arm if you try to touch it. That when you get down into here to Neanderthals, which everybody used to be the missing link, right? Used to be the caveman missing link. But now everybody knows that Neanderthal was a man. Nobody argues with that. Had culture, had religion, apparently. Buried their dead. They got lots of skeletons there. Whole skeletons. Rhodesian man, solo man, no, Homo erectus, don't have much there. But that's how they do it. Now, I don't mind them doing that. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I don't mind them doing that. I just feel like that beginning students ought to know that's being done. What's wrong with that? Let's just show them where the evidence is and how it's put together. Now, how would I view this from my point of view? I just tell you, I don't believe that you can tell whether something... completely, whether something is animal or human, ape or man, by looking at the skeleton alone. Not even if you have the whole skeleton. You need to know something about whether it can talk, whether it has reflective thinking. You need to know something about its behavior. Because nobody in a gorilla colony, if one of the gorillas kills another one, we do not have court proceedings. And we don't have court proceedings because we don't view them as human. And we don't view that as murder. And everybody agrees on that. And all I'm saying is that if you could have seen the whole creature on any of these, I think you'd have known right off whether it was ape or human. Now, can I prove that scientifically? No. Can they prove theirs scientifically? No. Which one do you believe? Well, it's a matter of what you think is most reasonable. But it'll be a matter of faith. It won't be a matter of fact. Now, that's the way I've tried to approach this entire discussion. And what I generally do is go down. See, this is Neanderthaler. He doesn't look like the ape man that you see in most of the books, does he? He was reconstructed by a forensic specialist, the guy that Gorski Park was the film that was on where they had a forensic specialist at Gorki Park or something like that. They had a forensic specialist putting these people's faces back together. You know, people do that for a living. I don't know why. But they do that for a living. And I think he looks kind of modern when you put him together this way. And one of the things that they have helped us to see, here he is on the top. That's the side view of the same guy. And when you draw him out that way, he looks a whole lot more modern than the way you normally see him. And all of this is artistic interpretation, depending on how you think he must have looked, which obviously goes back to how you think he came into existence and whether you believe in evolution or not, right? Now, I really don't mind him doing that. I'm just going to tell you that honestly. I think a scientist, I think anybody has the right to go any direction they want and what they think's most reasonable, and if they can get grant money to do that kind of research, I'm not going to argue with it. I just think students ought to know that. Let's show them what the actual evidence is and then show them the different interpretations and let them make up their own mind instead of trying to cram one philosophic position down their throat or the other, which is being done in some schools, like I think where Jerry Falwell is, Liberty Baptist College, they don't allow anything in there except the Bible, and they don't let them look. You know, to me, that's just as bad as going the other direction. I just don't like that. God gave us a mind to reason, a reasoned faith. Sanctify the Lord heart, the Lord God in your heart, giving an answer to every man that asks you a reason of the hope that's in you with meekness and fear. God tells us not only that we are to reason, but we are to give answers to people about why we reason that way, why we have that hope, and tells us how to do it in a kind way with meekness and fear. None of this random raving and I hate you and you're ugly and didn't like your mother anyway. That kind of stuff does not help discussions like this. It just sidetracks people into emotional sidetrack. That's what I call it. Emotional sidetrack. Now, a fellow by the name of Kit, I can't remember if that's his name or not. It's a book called The Bone Peddlers, and occasionally these names slip my mind. Somebody told me that was a function of my age. You know, as you got older, that you began to forget things. They always give the three indicators of senility. There's loss of memory, and I don't remember what the other two are. But this chart is really an interesting chart, because what he does is he goes back and he takes all of these proposed ancestors of man that at some time have held the hallowed position of being the so-called missing link. And he tells who discovered it and when and on what basis they said it and who promoted it and how long it lasted. And that's an interesting chart, because Ramapithecus, which was discovered by David Pilbeam in 1964, they now put Ramapithecus, that's the guy I had up earlier, they now put Ramapithecus as an ancestor to the orangutan. You know, which may be offensive to the orangutans, I don't know. In other words, that chart that I held up, where my professor asked me to draw the line, the evolutionists have drawn the line. This doesn't hold up anymore. And they felt free to reinterpret this. And they were telling me I couldn't get a master's if I disagreed with them, and now they've changed the whole thing themselves. And I don't think it's wrong to remind them of that. Now let's talk for a few minutes about genetics, because this gets us back into the mechanism of this whole thing, and it gets us back into this discussion of the general versus the special theory of evolution. The idea in genetics is, if we'll restrict the discussion to sexually reproducing organisms, okay, that the individuals of every species vary in size, in their proportions, in their coloration, in their internal and external structure, their physiology, and their habits. And as I pointed out to you, you could take some of the differences even down to the biochemical level, although most of the similarity that I'd try to point out if I were promoting that idea would be at the biochemical level. And I think you'll find in most of these books that are anti-creationism, that they spend a lot of time on the biochemical approach to life and a lot of these biochemical arguments. Okay? Rather than make you read that and then take that test, I'll just explain it to you. what they are postulating, and now this is the common view that some people are questioning now. Some of you may have read articles about Stephen Jay Gould and his punctuated equilibrium, you know, and I'm not going to talk about that right now. Okay, I'm just going to talk about the way it is normally presented in the textbook. And that is that evolution is a process whereby small changes occur over a very long period of time, and all of those little small changes add up and can account for all of the different kinds of organisms that we find on the face of the planet today or that have lived here and are extinct. All the plants, all of the animals, and that the mechanism for that is found within the field of modern genetics. Now that's basically how they use it. They believe in change with no limits to it. Small changes and never any limits to it. Now Darwin talked about that, and he was impressed by a fellow by the name of Thomas Malthus, who had written an essay on population, which gave us our first modern day concept about exponential population growth. You know, you get that talked about a lot of places. You know, the increasing number of people and the tremendous population explosion are the kinds of ways it's usually referred to. The idea, you know, that 2 produce 4, produce 8, produce 16, produce 32, and before you know it, we'll be knee-deep in elephants. That kind of thing. And people give out these little statistics on how it only take about 15 years to fill the entire world with a population of elephants if you just start out with 2 elephants and have exponential growth. And they only have the babies once every 9 years. I mean, it's not like us. It just takes a long time to get an elephant. And Darwin was impressed by that because he noticed that in reality, we are not knee-deep in elephants or any other organism. That in the natural environment, populations of organisms tend to level off at some level, and there's only and it kind of stays stable. Right? I mean, you've got the number of gray squirrels on the block, and, you know, if there are no gray squirrels there, you know, the population may increase real rapidly for a while, but after a while, it kind of levels off. And they came to the conclusion that something's killing off those things. Okay, they're not all living, they're competing. Okay, there's not enough food to go around, there's not enough space to go around. The kind of thing we're concerned about with our human family, because we're still going up, skyrocketing, and we're wondering what's going to happen when we run out of food. And, you know, we're concerned about that too. The point is that someplace in the environment there's something that's limiting the amount or the number of individuals that can exist in a given population of organisms. And within that population of gray squirrels, you've got some whose tails are a little long. Y'all just don't realize it. You think you've seen one gray squirrel, you've seen them all. But if you look close, you know, some are much better looking than others. But you've got to study that for a while. And so Darwin's theory of natural selection is basically this, that organisms tend to multiply at this geometric rate, all right? But that the number of individuals within a species tends to remain remarkably constant. It levels off out there, just like I showed you. And he concluded that there was a struggle for survival. And I guess I would too. Because some of those individuals are dying off. Now, let me ask you this. Which ones do you think would survive? The ones that were best adapted for getting whatever was limiting in that environment. They were a little faster, a little stronger, a little more adept at getting the food, and they lived long enough to have offspring and pass their genetics on to their offspring. And the ones that weren't quite so swift, okay, now the old race goes to the swift. The ones that weren't quite so swift, didn't get enough food, got sick, died, didn't have any offspring, and their genetics got passed out of them. It just disappeared from the population.
I had a friend who was a Christian down in Chipley, Florida. Anybody know where Chipley, Florida is? I tell you, no world travelers around here. In the panhandle of Florida, there's a place called Chipley. One of the first places I presented lessons like this to an entire high school audience in a gymnasium. And this fella told me about an example of this that he had seen, because he used to hunt quail. And he said there was this one area that they used to go to all the time. With that M before I smack one of these little ones on the front row. And he said you could scare up coveys of quail all over the place. You know, it was just people's favorite place to hunt. When he was a kid, all these fond memories about going and hunting there. But he remembers, even as a child, that there were some of those quail that did not scare up, but ran off through the brush. Genetic difference in their behavior. Does that make sense to you? I'm not going fast for them taking notes. He went back about 25 years later and he said, you couldn't square. Erase that from the tapes. I made a mistake. You couldn't scare up any quail, but you could hear them all over the place. Now, why do you suppose that was? Because the one what was dumb enough to fly up got shot. And the ones that ran off through the brush lived to produce offspring, and you changed the genetics of that little population, and it all shifted in favor of the ones that ran off through the brush. Well, that's Darwin's natural selection, just so you know. And I don't quarrel with Darwin on that. And we need to be real careful that we don't hold up the Bible and hold up Origin of Species and say that they are totally contradictory one to another, because they aren't. And that kind of talk on both sides. Now, you don't expect an evolutionist to make that distinction, do you? Between special and general, he loses a lot of his case. So we need to be careful in making that distinction. Darwin wasn't wrong on that. We only run into problems with him when he extrapolated off of that, and he said that was the mechanism by which everything happens. And man descended from the apes. Now that's where we really did. He shifted from the special theory of evolution or natural selection, and he shifted into the general theory. You know, the amoeba to man type thing. They keep the two together, and that's why we've been hard on him. But he wasn't wrong on this. The variations exist between members of a species, and the ones that were strong enough with favorable, who already had favorable variations, were the ones who survived. They didn't develop the variation after the condition came into existence. They already had it. Okay, if all of a sudden a fire broke out in here, and I don't mean to be morbid, but let's just look at a real example. If a fire broke out in here, the ones who were likely to live and produce offspring are the ones fast enough to get after it. And speed could be very important, right? Speed and agility. And those who were not fast and not agile anymore might get caught in here and die, both young and old. And that's all he was saying. And that's all he really said with his finches. Now, I do have problems when they say that mechanism explains it all. Because it doesn't explain it all. Let me just look as we close. See, I knew I'd find that. Remember I told you? Don't remember I told you about that? You don't care that I told you about that about an hour ago. This is that extinct ox that the Russian geneticists bred backwards and reproduced. And that's what it looks like in the flesh, so to speak. Not bad, huh? That's really pretty close. Been extinct for 300 years. But in order to establish the general theory of evolution, you would have to keep working that backwards until you got down to the reptiles.
where that ox was supposed to originally have evolved from. And nobody's ever done that and don't have any fossils that show that that ever happened. Now let me just show you, I've said several times, and I'm going to shut up after this and we'll talk for a while, because you have specific questions. Can't cover everything on this. I can't do all my stuff on paleontology and on the age of the earth, because I just don't have enough time. And I'm sorry, it's not because I'm avoiding them. I go through the same process with them, evidence and two interpretations. Okay? I just don't have time to do that today. But I have said several times that no genetic mechanism exists to support the general theory of evolution of change with no limits. And here is the place I'd like to go to just demonstrate that. The common answer if you challenge a person on that is, well, you know, how you can't just breed anybody in the human family. You can't just take this person and say, I want you to breed with this person. I'm going to check the offspring and I'm going to examine all the characteristics. We only do that with experimental organisms. And one that has become the experimental tool for geneticists is the fruit fly. And if they quibble with you, it is the vinegar fly, but everybody calls it the fruit fly. So don't let them quibble with you. It's the same fly. And this little fruit fly, they use it as an experimental tool for a simple reason. From two parents, you get hundreds of little bitty baby flies in about 9 to 11 days. I mean, that's the generation time. And they've gotten right sophisticated on this. You can buy this and do a high school science fair project with your fruit flies, just like they do big time in the colleges. Thomas Hunt Morgan was the one who started this, and it's been going on for years and years and years now in laboratories all over the United States and all over the world. And, you know, this is the one where they're mapping the chromosomes and all of this, and they've just learned so much about genetics from this little fly. How many generations do you feel like they've gone through? You only got a 9 to 11 day turnaround. Yeah, sure, it's tough to go through human evolution this way, do these kinds of experiments. You know, because you got an average generation time of 20 to 35 years, that kind of thing. And you don't get too many offspring, just one or two, three kids, maybe 5, 10 occasionally. You know, you can't do statistical studies. You can do statistical studies on the various characteristics you find with flies because you got 100 or 200 offspring from the same parent. And they've done it. They've done it. Look at all the changes that they've made. You've got your normal eyes and all these different variations until they've bred them where they don't have eyes.